Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to open up the interim committee of the Education and Workforce Development. We have a little bit of business to do today in introducing the bills that we'll consider in the next session. What I'd like to do is have short information on both of those bills, and then we'll vote to go through those. And then we will take a look at a couple of important issues, including the instruction relating to anti-Chinese discrimination, the Education Equity and Emergency Act, sponsored by Senator Knope, accelerated study and associate programs, and talk about that from Senator Close, and then the career and technical education revitalized programs. These are all fairly brief, but there's a lot of them, so appreciate your patience. Administrator Donovan can give us a quick briefing on the committee hearings, the committee bills.
Okay. I'm going to be available.
Sure. We'll open up the informational hearing on LC 55 and LC 56.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The committee has requested and had drafted two different measures for potential committee introduction. The first measure is LC 55. It's the Oregon Promise Community College funding measure. It's been considered by the committee in our September and our November hearings, and it would direct the HEC, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, to study 2 years or the equivalent thereof of free tuition for Oregon high school graduates. Could be community college, university, but it directs the HEC to take a look at that potential program. The other measure is LC 56. It is an omnibus measure. It is relating to education, so it has a very broad relating to clause. There are a number of items in the bill. There's a flyer in the back, a short memorandum that lists the operative items. All of the items are technical in nature. They are relating to higher education and to K through 12 education both. They recreate a task force concerning regional educational services delivery. They allow the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to enter into interstate agreements at the request of legislative council here in the Capitol. There is some direction for constitutional interpretation of property and employees relating to the State Board of Higher Education. There are a lot of things in the measure that are basically technical in nature, and I believe the committee anticipates potentially adding other items as need be.
To qualify to get into that bill, the provision cannot be controversial. That's what we've done in the last two special sessions. It seems to work and seems to be appropriate for these kinds of sessions. So let's start off. There's been a lot of talk about this promise, the idea of a community college for high school graduates that's affordable or free. And in the discussion of this, I ran across some executives from Cisco Systems and said that we want to be part of this. Here's some ideas to think about in terms of bringing the cost of college down, community college in particular. So let's bring the Cisco team up if we can.
Thank you. So did we introduce the bills already?
No.
Finance first.
Good afternoon.
So my name is Rob Vasks. I'm with Cisco Systems. Chairman Haas, members of the committee, thanks so much for inviting me in here today to really talk about how technology can address some of these education concerns. So just a quick highlight of myself. So through Cisco, I've been supporting K-12 and higher ed institutions in Oregon for coming up on 15 years. Disclaimer, I'm also a product of the Oregon education system. I was a proud graduate of Oak Hills Elementary School in Beaverton School Districts. Went to Aloha High School and graduated from U of O with a couple degrees. Not to date myself too much, but back then tuition was, I looked at it, it was $323 for a 17 credit term. So I've been in the process for quite a while. So enough about me. Really the purpose for me being here today is a couple fold. Really want to talk about how connected learning solutions can help on a couple levels. Obviously, the community college incentive program, how can technology help mitigate some of those costs and then ensure success of that program? And then secondly, we understand that that's going to be a long-term project, so let's take a look at maybe how some of those solutions can also help with some of the more immediate needs relative to the initiatives and other goals within K-12 and higher ed in Oregon. So the approach that we'd like to take is let's kind of highlight some of those key initiatives, talk about some of the challenges that we see, some of the opportunities, and then specifically how technology can maybe address the challenges and hopefully create some synergies and really leverage the opportunities at hand. So the Community College Incentive Program. Obviously, if we're going to offer higher ed for a couple years at either zero or small cost to the students, enrollment's going to be huge. How can we help mitigate some of those both operational and capital costs, and maybe even as important, the space constraints? How can we deal with implementing student solutions and without having to build, frankly, new buildings and so forth right out of the gate? And, of course, resources. We're going to need a lot more teachers, a lot more professors, and the resources of the administration behind that. So at the same time, how can we address that, yet also optimize access? We're going to have a whole lot of, hopefully, willing learners in the program, give them access to the tools, keep them engaged, and probably most importantly, make sure that they succeed through the program. I would imagine that one of the success criteria is going to be not just that they come into the program, but they actually exit in 2 years and not before that and go on to future, whether it's a workforce or education initiatives. And then another one we put on here is how can we potentially start that process a little bit earlier, meaning as high school kids or seniors, we typically see a lot more flexibility and some gaps in their schedules. Can we maybe leverage technology to insert them into the higher ed process a little bit sooner, give them a springboard into some of the resources in community colleges or other higher ed, and use technology to do a couple things, keep them either in the schools, so that the high schools at that time, so they can access easily or maybe even from home. Obviously, a great entity is the Oregon Education Investment Board. They've got some pretty lofty goals. How can we help with technology ensure learning equity, teaching equity, from a couple perspectives, not just based on location, based on demographic, and based on the economic condition? Let's make sure that we give them easy access to all the tools that they need. And part of that, too, is simply improving efficiencies in the teaching and learning process, making sure that those teachers have the skill sets they need while keeping them in the classroom as much as we can. And then from an overall stakeholder perspective, let's use some of those same tools to increase collaboration and communication amongst the stakeholders within the board and the goals that we're trying to accomplish there. Another one, and I've sat in on some of the different discussions in the committees, and there's no better way for a student to be integrated into the workforce and be ready for it than to have access to business leaders and businesses while they're in school. So are there ways that we can leverage technology to, first of all, once we have willing business partners, allow them easy access to the students, and then at the same time give the students a broader access to those resources? Namely, let's make sure this is not a siloed event, not one student to one business leader, but a classroom to a myriad of resources, and make that part of the curriculum. And then once we have a teachable moment, let's make sure we can capture that. Can we capture that information for debrief later or as an archive for future curriculum? So now we're not building things over and over again. We've got some resources and materials already in play. And of course, none of this happens without effective education. And obviously, this leads to how can we make sure that the process from onboarding a teacher to professional development to career development is absolutely streamlined. Again, teachers need to be in the classroom. They're strapped for time. Let's make sure we find the right resources. We can make it easy to make sure we have a diverse workforce relative to some of the other equity goals that we have. And again, streamline that process. Once we bring them on, let's make sure they're active contributing teachers sooner rather than later. And just another quick point, and again, in listening to some of the different conversations, if we can keep them happy, frankly, we can keep them in Oregon. We've invested time and money into them. Let's make sure we give them a career path so that they stay in Oregon and are continuing to be contributors here. And then just a quick note on Common Core, obviously a huge initiative in the state. With that comes learning curves and resource needs. Let's make sure that as we improve professional development for these teachers, that the goals and the needs and the challenges of Common Core are also integrated into that. And again, you'll see in a bit how technology can help us get there. So like I say, good news, there is a way to make that happen. From our perspective, we really look at this as a connected learning experience. And a couple things need to happen. First of all, since we are going to be reaching out remotely to a lot of teachers, students, professors, let's make sure that that is still a rich media experience for them, that it's as interactive as it can be or as interactive as it needs to be, and that we can start simple and grow from there, depending on the needs and the growth, hopefully in the demand. The paramount tenet for us is, since we're going to be reaching out, we're really going to be changing the paradigm of teaching, reaching out to a lot more remote folks, let's absolutely make sure that we're not compromising the quality of the education that we're providing to the students. Let's make sure that that product we've delivered is effective as it's been real time, if you will. So I won't go through all of them, but just suffice it to say we've got a lot of different solutions relative to the environment, from an immersive environment where we've got dedicated classrooms, dedicated auditoriums, a great component of the true blended learning and lecture capture opportunities that are out there. A little more flexibility with multi-purpose devices. Now we can pretty much turn any classroom into an opportunity to collaborate. And in some cases, these items are also portable. So now we can retrofit rooms, but not invest in every single room to make this kind of solution happen. And then we get a little more portable. Now we can really turn any room into an opportunity to collaborate with teachers, students, administrators, again, whatever the case might be. The nice thing is, if you look at the underpinnings of this, the pipes and the gears, if you will, all of this leads to the next and really important one, and that's anytime, anywhere connectivity. Let's make sure that regardless of the device, regardless of where somebody is, they still get a rich media experience as they enter into the learning and teaching process. Anything from a notebook to, in most cases, smartphones, iPods, iPads, Chrome devices, we can absolutely address that. Key as these initiatives, as you've seen across the state, a lot more mobile learning, and a big part of the flipped classroom, which if we have time, we can talk about that too. So let's just take a look at a couple examples. We talked about the obvious space constraints relative to the number of folks that we anticipate enrolling in hopes of the community college initiative passing. There's no reason we can't do the same thing for K-12. A lot of schools have a whole lot of portables. That's their way of expanding. Let's look at other ways to do that, just like we would with community colleges. So let's take just a quick example. Chemeketa Community College, they have a dental tech as well as a drafting tech class. Maybe the subject matter expert there is one of few in the state. Why not allow that subject matter expert to expand that class out to, say, Eastern Oregon, Southern Oregon, Central Oregon Community College, and easily reach out and provide that same interactive learning with that same scarce resource across the state? And we said we're going to need to reach out to a whole lot more students in the process. Same thing here. Let's give them that same interactive, rich access regardless of where they're at, whether they're working from home, studying from a coffee shop, maybe leveraging one of the Workforce Oregon locations, or even on the road. So if you look at it here, we've multiplied the size of the classroom without spending a whole lot of money on buildings, if any, and we've dramatically expanded the ability to address this huge enrollment that we anticipate seeing. And I think you'd agree at a significantly less investment than building new buildings. And frankly, doing it a heck of a lot faster, which is something I'm sure we'll want to do, is let's ramp this program quickly. Just a quick note here as we talk about the other stakeholders. The point is we can leverage the same services and the same infrastructure to improve communications and collaborations for everything that we support in education, from, again, the boards, K-12, ESDs, the third-party consultants. Let's make it easier to communicate, easier to collaborate, reduce travel, reduce the costs there. The end game here really is, since we're doing things quicker, we can come to decisions faster, we can disseminate information quicker, get our messaging out to the constituents a lot easier. And again, we talked about connecting to the world of work. Let's make that easy. While we can certainly do so within the state of Oregon, why not expand the bounds and provide a lot more flexibility in curriculum, because we can reach out to businesses across the country. And maybe equally as importantly, we can reach out to schools who might have similar goals for some of their students. Let's share best practices with the resources that we have. You know, a quick example, imagine we've got a CIO or a CEO in Utah. Let's allow him to easily actually get into this classroom face-to-face, one-to-many, as an interactive engagement, and assuming it goes well, we can record and capture this from the video and the audio to the comments to the questions to any content that's being shared, and again, use that for debrief later or in a future class. Maybe tying that into to higher education, it might be a research department or a research institute. Let's use that same technology to reach out and do some real-time collaboration, maybe with the researchers that are out in the field. And again, we said educator effectiveness is absolutely paramount, from recruit to assessment to review. Let's use tools such that mentors, peers, other collaborators are easily accessible and can share ideas with each other and frankly make things happen faster. Just a quick note, we talked about the Common Core. Well, Nevada and California are going down the same path. If they're at a different phase of the process, why not use technology to talk with them, best practices that they've learned, maybe challenges that they've had, and lessons that they've learned. And then another just quick note from a recruiting perspective. Let's get teachers the right ones quickly and get them on board fast. A great way to do that is if we have candidates around the state, around the country, let's invite them to a quick video interview for the first phase, get that process going, narrow it down to the right folks. And again, we've attained something quickly and hopefully getting these folks contributing sooner rather than later. So good news, some of the investments already been made in the state. A couple things I'll just highlight real quick. The university system, primarily Oregon State, they actually have a fairly robust video bridging platform today. Now, admittedly, it's not going to do everything that we've talked about in terms of addressing that out of the gate, but the point is there's a foundation there to build from or to add on to, and maybe as important, there's a skill set in place so that we can get some support out of the gate, along with some of our resources that we'll talk about. I don't know if any of you had exposure to the Crook County Open Campus. This is a perfect example of technology at work. The challenge there was here, along with some of the other remote areas around the state, they lost access to some of the learning materials due to budget issues back in about 2003. Oregon State said, let's create these open campuses. One of those was Crook County. As you can see, they actually built a facility, but within that, they put video conferencing gear, high-def cameras, and then an infrastructure to allow them to connect back to Oregon State, to Central Oregon Community College, other resources they wouldn't otherwise have access to. They've got capabilities to record and replay, and then at the same time, while they've got the real-time access, they can also push content and classes out around the community to folks that can't make it into this location. They took it one more step. I call this the 21st century Bookmobile. This is actually a classroom on wheels, complete with video conferencing capabilities. They have a satellite link on this, kind of the Al Franken mobile uplink unit, if you guys remember Saturday Live from way back when. Again, I'm dating myself. So they can actually take this out into the field. They frankly do have some challenges with the satellite link, but the point is they're really bringing technology out to where other folks otherwise either couldn't get there or they might have broadband issues and not have bandwidth to take advantage of some of the other stuff. Here's a great one. You guys have probably all heard of WebEx, and whether you realize it or not, probably used it at some point. The education department here has invested in this for about the last 4 years. And as you can see, this is web-based, one-to-many or one-to-many-many. High, rich content sharing, high-def video, and, of course, audio. And, again, like we talked about, real important, the ability to create an interactive experience. Just a couple examples of question-and-answer opportunities, polling, and other things to really draw the attendees in as much as you might need to. And are they using it? Absolutely. Some quick proof points. This last year, as you can see, we're rolling up on almost 900,000 minutes, almost a million minutes of collaboration just within the Oregon the Department of Education WebEx environment. That represented about 13,000 attendees. And I think the key number here is also represented zero hardware and zero software for the state of Oregon for the Department of Ed to manage, because this is a cloud service. Cisco manages it. You have a new user, we give them a login. Cisco gives them the training. They're now set to set up and tear down WebEx as the parts continue. So I'm going fast because we've covered a lot of material. Suffice it to say, there's so many different tools, and this is just some of them that we've outlined to address a lot of the different things. Our job as Cisco and as consultants and partners out there is to map the right solutions and resources to what the state's trying to accomplish. The point is we've got a lot of resources. I'm with our local team. We have a local sales and engineering team. Our management and our operational team that map directly to public sector is based in Lake Oswego. Most of our collaboration specialists are in the Northwest. Those are the smart guys that make all this stuff work. And we've got a great telepresence studio. If nothing else, we'd love for you to come up and experience it. But more importantly, it gives us access to our nationwide resources, which means you and all the stakeholders we've talked about also have access to those many subject matter experts for consulting engagements, and maybe as important, access to your peers around the country. We talked about some local examples. Suffice to say, we've got a lot of K-12 and higher ed customers out there that have faced similar challenges and have a lot of successes that they can share, and again, it's lessons learned. So as we said, we'd love to ideally bring you and the appropriate folks up to Lake O, experience the technology, maybe set up some sessions with the right folks. But what I want to leave here today with is hopefully we started a discussion such that down the road we can have a conversation on working together to put together a statewide strategy relative to connected learning for the state of Oregon. And again, I can't stress enough, we're here as a resource. We want to work with you. For the record, I'm your chief of contact.
Questions for Cisco? Senator Cruz?
A couple. I mean, you talk about infrastructure needs. There's a lot of the state that doesn't have the broadband capacity you're talking about. So there's definitely an infrastructure issue that will need to be addressed. And you say hardware and software, a lot of our kids don't have the devices either. So, I mean, there is some front end, you know, if it's going to be for everybody. There's clearly some front-end things that need to be addressed, I would think.
Oh, yes, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. But, and if I can say that, kind of to my last point, two things. If you look at most of the resources I addressed, they can cover a lot of the different concerns that we have. So that's why we'd love to get together and actually put a statewide strategy together to kind of create some synergies there.
I mean, if we need more towers or whatever we need, I mean, in my part of the world, there's places that phones don't even work.
Yeah.
So
you must be remote then, huh?
This will help. This will help.
Yeah, no, you can crank
it. Okay. those work, huh?
Nice. Well, we'll need your help. You know, a lot of what you said, frankly, Rob, kind of, you know, dazzled us, went over our heads. But the population we're talking about is around 18 years old. They were born 96, around there. That was the first year that Google was founded. So this is the digital generation. And probably, I'm guessing that a lot of what you're discussing here is more familiar, or they're more comfortable with it than maybe we are.
Oh, yeah.
And so if this is ever going to come to pass, we will not be able to do it without technology. So we're going to be counting on you.
We're here to help.
Continue to help. So
if I can say one more thing, and we didn't talk about it, you talk about that digital generation. The reality is we'll be competing for those students, and they will go where they can get that technology that they're comfortable with. We see that time and time again across the country, so we can help compete there as well.
Okay. Senator Roebling.
I was just going to say, so you still do the routers and all the other stuff?
Yes, we do.
It's always been noted for us.
And I didn't want to say we're not the coleslaw and the straws. We are the routers and the switch company.
I do realize that.
Well, that's Cisco.
Yeah. I get that a lot.
That is the Cisco.
I'm with the networking company, and they still say, oh, yeah, my brother-in-law drives truck for you guys.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Rob.
Is that what you were hoping to get? Great. Thank you so much. I look forward to working with you guys.
Mr. Chair, if I could, just one other thing. You know, we're talking about free access to community colleges, and we're talking there's got to be money here somewhere, because I'm looking at a community college system that is significantly underfunded now, and how we keep them whole in all this has got to be a key component.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we have Ben Cannon, and I think Hilda is here to talk about the Omnibus education bill, now LC 56. You guys, I'm not sure how you want to divvy up.
The omnibus bill sounds ominous.
Is it omnibus or ominous? Which one is it?
That's the secret to be in this. It cannot be ominous.
Better not. For the record, Mr. Chair, Ben Cannon, I'm the Executive Director for the state's Higher Education Coordinating Commission. And I had a hand both in my previous role as the Governor's Education Policy Advisor as well as in my current one in helping the Chair and committee staff in thinking about some of the and working on some of the what I would characterize mostly as technical changes that may be necessary to make Senate Bill 270, which this committee spent ample time on last session, work as intended. So I'm prepared to walk through at least portions of the draft that's before you, understanding that you'll have more time, I expect, and more interest in February when we have an introduced
bill. We have these drafts. We also have the memo I think everybody has that Richard handed out to. It's a little more user-friendly. But.
Well, I'm happy to dive in at your pleasure and talk about a couple of the components of this, and we'll see where questions or interest may head. And Hilda's here as well and can support me, particularly in the discussion of the state authorization reciprocity agreement, which is not described in this bill directly but is indirectly, and I'll point that out. So the bill launches, and I'm sure this is in your summary, with what I believe are really technical and LC-driven changes about clarifying the role of the HEC in certain respects as advisory to the Oregon Education Investment Board. I think those are appropriate changes that were intended for the original House Bill 3120. On page 4, there is the provision that provides the Higher Education Coordinating Commission with the authority to enter into and administer certain types of interstate agreements regarding the provision of post-secondary distance education. And I hope during the legislative session to have the opportunity to bring real experts, including Sana Andrews, the provost at Portland State University, Larry Large, who represents the independent colleges and universities, and Alan Contreras, who works at the Western Interstate Commission on Higher Education, or WICHE, they are among the many people around the country who have been attempting to figure out how to get a handle on this world of distance education in higher education, and in particular, private and for-profit, as well as public and nonprofit higher education institutions that are offering courses in potentially 50 states around the country, and under the current regulatory system that our states operate, having to seek approval by each and every one of those 50 states for the provision of degrees to students in those states, even though they may have no physical presence in that state. So, for example, an Indiana university that attempts to provide an Oregon student with course and a degree comes through now the Higher Education Coordinating Commission and its Office of Degree Authorization for approval to do business in Oregon and provide that student with coursework and degree. And the state authorization reciprocity agreement is an interstate partnership designed by the Western Interstate Commission on Higher Education and its regional counterparts to make sense of and create reciprocity in this world of online education, helping to diminish the regulatory burden for institutions while enhancing quality and consumer protection for students. It can get complex, as you can imagine, from that description. And again, I hope that we can bring some experts to the committee. Certainly, if you have questions today, Hilda and I can do our best to, you know, share where we think Sarah, which is what this reciprocity agreement is known as, is at, and go where you will.
Mr. Chair. You know, it's one of the things when we're looking at online curricula for K-12 is making sure that the rigor is there. I'm assuming somehow that's addressed in all this as well. I mean, reciprocity is fine, but you still have to prove up, right?
I'll take a crack at it, and Hilda may have something to add. Yes, the proposed reciprocity agreement has certain standards that any state that participates in the agreement ensures that its own institutions, that it remains responsible, including ones that are doing distance education to other states, are meeting. and likewise every other state would be required to meet those standards. So there would be some basic assurance of quality and integrity of the programs or degrees that are being offered.
Thank you.
Sure. Further questions on LC 56? Hello?
I think one of the things that this allows us to do is to continue working with, Hilda Roselli, Deputy Director for College and Career Readiness with the Oregon Education Investment Board. And Chair Haas, one of the things that this does allow us to do is to just take that next step forward as the SARA agreement continues to roll out, and to also pay attention to those areas that we want to make sure that we establish a high level of integrity around recruitment practices within the state, looking at the workload that and who would handle the student complaint issues, which is another requirement of the agreement, and really working with our universities and institutions and programs to make sure that they have their questions answered before we agree to any agreement, but this allows us to enter into an interstate agreement.
Mr. Chair, committee, are there other provisions in the bill? I'm sure they're alluded to in your memo. I'm happy to describe. I'm not confident yet that these are in precisely the shape that you intend for them to be in, but we'll continue to work with you on making sure that they do what you mean for them to do.
Okay, and we even have a couple. We will have a couple amendments to this bill as the weeks go on. We just heard about a couple of them an hour ago. So, and they fall into the low bar of technical housekeeping. So, thank you both.
Great, thanks.
I'm going to close the informational hearing on our committee legislative concepts, and I'm going to open up a work session on our committee legislative concepts.
Chair Haas, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 55 relating to community college costs, and LC 56 relating to education.
Senator Knope moves the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 55 and LC 56. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, measures are introduced as committee bills, and I close that order of business. And then go into an informational hearing about Chinese discrimination. We have a team of people today. I'll just ask the team to come forward, and you can introduce yourselves when you begin. Why don't one of you start off and just kind of set the stage for us?
Chair Haas and other senators. I'm Mari Watanabe. I am with the Oregon Commission on Asian and Pacific Islander Affairs, and I want to thank you today for allowing us to speak. First, I'd actually like to thank you for passing Senate Bill 739 last session, which is a bill that will educate students about our multicultural history in Oregon. Today, I'm actually here in support of the work of the Chinese American Citizens Alliance in their efforts to include the history of America's Chinese exclusion laws in our history classes. So I think you have a PowerPoint in front of you. I'm going to whip through these pretty fast. Chinese Americans are virtually absent from Chinese textbooks. From history textbooks. Historical facts, such as the one that Chinese Americans served in the U.S. military, is largely unknown. Oregonian Hazel Ying Lee, a Chinese American woman aviator in World War II, she actually taught men how to fly, which I thought was pretty cool. She was denied burial in Riverton Cemetery in Portland because the location was for whites only. Also little known is the magnitude of what Chinese Americans have contributed to the economic development of Oregon. Contributions of cheap labor spanning major industries added to the success and growth of the economy here in Oregon. These historic contributions have been underrecognized. In addition to their contributions as a result of their physical labor, they contributed significantly in the revenue generated for state and local governments. This is a photo of the first transcontinental railroad that was built by 3,000 Chinese workers. Although the lowest paid, the Chinese were the highest taxed. By 1858, taxes collected from the Chinese covered all local government expenses in southern Oregon's Josephine County. And here's a map, a historical map of where the Chinese lived in the western United States. This is a chart of the population in Oregon between 1870 and 1890. But in Portland, the Chinese became the largest ethnic group by the mid-1870s. In Oregon's constitution, they were denied the right to own property. They were also denied the right to U.S. citizenship. And posters such as these really added to the anti-Chinese sentiment, all of which led to the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act. Chinese could no longer immigrate to the United States. They could not become naturalized citizens. And it was the first time in U.S. history a specific ethnic group was barred from immigrating. This is a photo of the preamble of the law. And this characterizes Chinese laborers as an imminent threat to, quote, good American order, unquote. Congress passed the Chinese Exclusion Act five separate times and made it permanent in 1904. And actually, this resulted in all Asians being barred from immigrating. The act was repealed in 1943 after 60 years when China became our World War II ally. The impact of this Exclusion Act legitimized discrimination towards the Chinese, which translated at times into violent action. One example in Oregon is the grisly massacre of 34 Chinese miners on the Oregon side of Hell's Canyon. Some bodies were found hacked to death and decapitated. The accused white murderers were found not guilty despite a confession. Other impacts were to families. Wives and children could not immigrate, thus condemning the Chinese men to a bachelor existence. These men could not live a family life here. The 1882 project is a national movement led by the Chinese American Citizens Alliance. The goal of the project is to educate others about the Chinese Exclusion Act. Our own U.S. Congress apologized for this wrong in 2001 with the Senate and in 2012 with the House. And now I'd like to turn the mic over to two native Oregonians that are here to tell their personal stories of how the Chinese Exclusion Act affected their families.
Chair Hess, members of the committee, my name is Erica Wong, and I'm here today on behalf of the Chinese American Citizens Alliance and also as a native Portlander. I would like to share briefly with you the journey of how my family came to America. My great-grandfather came to America in 1860s as a merchant and soon opened a restaurant in Fargo, North Dakota. Due to Chinese immigrants not being able to bring their families, my grandfather, his son, later came from China to help run the restaurant. But when it came time for my own father to come to America, his journey was much more arduous. His first attempt was obstructed by World War II. His second attempt was impeded by the bureaucracy of the remnants of the Chinese Exclusion Act. Finally, in 1977, he made it to Portland through his sister, who had married an American citizen. At an age when most people are looking towards retirement, he got to start life over so his children would have the chance to live the American dream. Little of this information was shared with me growing up, as I'm sure it was difficult for my father to recall such anguish. In all my years through the Oregon school system, from elementary school through university, there was little mention of the Chinese American immigration story, and little mention of the contributions and sacrifices my ancestors and their countless countrymen made in shaping our great nation. It was only as an adult, after the death of my father, that I realized I needed to start asking questions and to do my own research. My father was a quiet man, but knowing what I know now makes me feel closer to him than I ever did when he was alive. Growing up, I never understood why he was always so diligent in putting up the American flag on all the major holidays, and why he insisted on only buying American cars. It's because he felt the need to cherish at every occasion that he was an American, and to acknowledge what it took in order for that to happen. I also understand now why he raised me the way he did, to never give up, because he, like so many other Chinese immigrants, never gave up, in search for a better life for themselves and their families. Knowing that I come from such resilient people, I have never been more proud to be Chinese American. However, I am also humbled by my ignorance and by the knowledge that the opportunities I have enjoyed in my life were not a given, but came at a great price by those who came before me. I have a 3-year-old niece who will soon follow the same educational path. My hope is that she will come into this knowledge much sooner than I did, and to know that her heritage is important and celebrated, just as much as other immigrant groups and minorities in this country. I thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Jacqueline Davis. I am a high school senior. I live in Portland, and I volunteer for the Chinese American Citizens Alliance. I'm also Chinese American. I thoroughly enjoy studying history, and one of the amazing things about educating people on the past is that they can find parallels and analogies to today's events, as well as examples. By learning about our past, it can assist us in figuring out what works and what doesn't. So students in their classrooms today learn about things such as war and genocide, usually in the hopes that the actions leading up to these things can be prevented. We even learn about phenomenons like economic depressions in an attempt to gain understanding and to improve in the future. However, we can only learn from these things because we know about them. Personally, in over 12 years of receiving my public education, I've only heard the Chinese exclusion laws mentioned once. Even then, it was simply a brief afterthought to a PowerPoint in my U.S. history course in 10th grade. These laws were also never mentioned in any of my textbooks. Furthermore, I was shocked to find that even though my mother's side of the family is Chinese, none of them had heard about this law either, or about these laws either. Not even my aunt and uncle had heard of them, and they're both teachers. So the only way that the few people that I know have heard about these exclusion laws is through the Chinese American Citizens Alliance. Americans need to know about these events so that they can comprehend the struggles of all their ancestors. What concerns me the most, though, is that the past can easily be repeated if we never learn from it. Students should know all aspects of our country's history, even if they are considered shameful, because that's the only way we can stop such injustice from happening again. I wholeheartedly believe that the ignorance surrounding these laws is a dilemma and that we should try our best to fix it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
We appreciate and share your commitment to the great education here in Oregon and your desire to be more inclusive about Oregon's history. As OCAPIA commissioner, I look forward to working with ODE and the other commissions to help find resources to build curriculum about our multicultural history. As a supporter of the Chinese American Citizens Alliance, we have a special ask of you today. Because we know it will take time for ODE to build these resources to help our teachers, we'd like to ask your support for this committee to help us ask OEIB in designating a day for history teachers to educate their students about the 1882 exclusion laws. We would also like to ask the committee's support to help fund professional development and curriculum development for teachers on this subject, because as Jackie mentioned, history is less likely to repeat itself if we are educated about the past. Thank you for letting us come and testify today. We appreciate your support.
Thank you for coming forward. Thank you for your stories. A committee, I met with these folks some time ago, and I think originally they were considering legislation to require the department to teach, to make sure this is taught. And I explained that we're sort of trained now not to tell the Department of Education what to teach and what not to teach. So we kind of arrived at this, and I think it's a good happy medium. I think raising awareness is probably the best. That
yes, absolutely.
Any questions for our panel?
I think raising awareness is the mess, and mine's mostly a statement. You know, we have a number of families that have been in the Coos Bay Area for a long time. The Wyes were good friends of mine, and he was a math teacher at the school. And we had a number of conversations. He went on to become a postman, and that's what he's been doing for a long time. But they had some of the very first stores in our community back in the 1800s. I mean, they have been a part of that community for many, many years. And it was through him that I learned some of the rather tragic history of Coos Bay with respect to the Chinese people in our community, and the fact that their family state is pretty remarkable. I mean, it was a pretty remarkable deal. And I think more and more people need to understand that. And the best way for, I think, communities and kids is to find those families that have history in those communities and have them make sure that that's part of what the schools talk about. You know, our kids have talked about that a lot because we had some friends. And, you know, elementary schools, when you bring the cultural history in and do stuff, the more you can connect it to people who actually they know across the street, the better the real understanding starts to take place.
Absolutely.
And I hope we can help with that across the state, because there wasn't a community in Oregon that didn't in the 1800s have Chinese people there. They weren't citizens at the time, but they were Chinese who were helping make those communities the places they are today. And I hope we don't lose that, and that some of those families come forward and show us, because your pictures are really important, visual representation, so people see, oh, yeah, that's our community, and you know, is really important. So I hope you continue to do that. I know the Portland Alliance has done a lot of stuff with that, and I hope they will continue. And I think this is one way of doing it, but we need to get into each of our little communities and each of those schools and have those conversations as time goes on. So, again, continue to keep in touch with us, because I think we'd all like to help.
Great.
So thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for sharing your stories. It's not easy to do. Your generation is willing. The previous generation was not.
Correct.
Yeah, I mean, I have no idea why it was there, but within that culture, that has been a difficult thing. And so I applaud you. There's a group of books now that are out that have been written, both from Japanese and Chinese early visitors and their families, and they're starting to get that out. I hope more of that happens. So thank you.
Thank you for those comments, Senator Brooklyn. I echo that sentiment. Thanks for coming. We'll be in touch. I do have, is Andrea Morgan here?
Yes.
Yeah. Andrea, can you come forward? Maybe address some of this. Thank you. Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for coming forward. Don't mean to put you in the hot seat here. The charge is this wasn't covered enough in history as it should be. Now, I don't think it's isolated to just Oregon either, but and the Department of Education says what to that?
Well, Chair Hass and committee, thank you for allowing me to be here to testify. I think it is one of the pieces that maybe isn't covered as often as other parts of history. Excuse me?
Could you start off with your ID?
Oh, sure. Andrea Morgan, Education Specialist at Oregon Department of Education, and with responsibilities for social sciences. And it's true. This isn't covered a lot, although to say it isn't covered, you know, might not be entirely accurate either, because it really depends on the school and the district as to whether it's covered or not. And I think it relates also to the professional development that teachers have had in this topic, because social studies teachers are finding that their instructional time has been more and more limited. You've probably heard that before, that with the advent of No Child Left Behind and testing, there's a lot more time spent on math and reading, and we've seen a decrease in the amount of time for social studies. That said, I think also we're finding that teachers just simply do not have background in some of these areas. And so to be able to provide more professional development and resources is going to be important. Senate Bill 739, the Oregon Studies Bill, one of the things that we are doing is working with the advocacy commissions and with the Oregon Historical Society to make sure that we have more resources available for teachers. And then hopefully come up with the ability to also have professional development events or ways that teachers can get this information. There's a lot of things in history, and I always think about the fact that it's difficult to pick and choose. With our standards, we've written them to broader concepts now because it's just impossible to include everything. I think about my own teaching career, and we've added well over a third of a century of history just in that amount of time, and that we don't always get to cover those events well either. it's not fair to students, I think, sometimes to put them through the death march of the, you know, the chronology where you start at one place and you try to cover every single event. And I think the strength in our standards now is that we're going to be able to choose more events so that we can do more depth and get a better understanding. This may be one of the topics that teachers are going to want to emphasize more as they get to the topics about how minorities have been treated in our state and in our nation, and in and then how we relate to one another throughout the world. So I see some good things coming out of the Oregon Studies bill in that the resources are going to be available. I think the next thing, the idea of more professional development for teachers, would be perfect.
It is one of the problems that the national textbooks have never addressed this issue, and we tend to go to those textbooks, I mean, especially in the last 20, 30 years prior to the digital age.
Chair House, I think that textbooks have changed a lot over time, and I think for a while there was more inclusion, and now things have become more generalized again. And it has to do with the political climate. Most textbook companies are reluctant to do anything that might be seen as controversial. Mm-hmm. And even though it's history and important history, sometimes they back off from important topics for fear that there are some that might find it objectionable or that there's too much emphasis on one group over another. And so what happens is, you know, my recommendation most of the time is that you not use a textbook because they've become somewhat watered down over time.
In the efforts to not offend anybody. It's,
yes.
That's... Yeah, I mean, that's a real issue.
Yep,
that is a real issue. Senator Byer.
It's very interesting. I think this is important that people, particularly Oregonians, know about this. And I was reflecting as I was listening. I think it was either in 95 or 97, we had a similar issue raised by the Irish, who experienced similar things coming out of the Irish famine, where a lot of people felt that wasn't taught, and we passed a bill doing that as they built the railroad coming from the eastern side. I'm not sure if that ever got incorporated either into the curriculum. I remember that the Department of Education was pretty strongly opposed to teaching about that subject at the time. I guess reflecting back, I've said a lot recently, as I remember in my elementary days, all the history and stuff that we were taught, only to learn now that most of it was wrong.
and I think we try so hard in our country and in our education to give clear examples of how things work. So we talk about government, and we have these three branches of government, and we talk about the Supreme Court, and we show all these examples that show how nice it works. And we forgot to point out that we had the same Constitution that didn't allow certain things that now does allow those, and we didn't have to change the Constitution to that. And it's that growing and living part that makes it the most exciting for many of us who got the history later, who were math and science people and liked math and science and didn't particularly like the social studies part. But when you find a really good social studies person who lets you find out that, oh, this may be what it said, but this is how the application was. That's what really excites people, and I hope that, because you're right, I think there's a lot more self-developed and information out there that's available through the internet, through other kinds of sources that you can get people to get engaged and involved. And I know that, at least in our AP class at our school, it totally changed education for a lot of my kids because they went to source documents and started looking at the stuff, and they started saying, well, how could you talk to me about this? I mean, my daughter has more than a few times, because she keeps going back at it, gotten upset with us because we were around and didn't do something about what happened in 1973. Did you know this was happening? And but we were here. And, you know, I mean, it's kind of like there's a new belief and a new searching of kids out there because they have that ability. And if you give them the tools, which is, I think, what education is trying to do now, is to give them the tools to go out and find that information and excite them to want to find that. And then how to make sense out of the whole thing. So we have been in a difficult place. And I used to always say to my social studies teachers as a principal, I don't know why we have so much trouble teaching our history. We're only a couple hundred years old. I was over in England, and they have a lot more history that they have to do, and they seem to know it. I mean, they seem to figure it out. And we've got to figure out what it is that gets this kind of stuff. And when I went and visited China a couple years ago, they have a lot longer history. And wow, they, even the people we saw, most of them knew more about their history than we had about ours. And I'm trying to figure out, how did this happen? How did they incorporate it in ways that they caught on to it and learned it, and we as Americans haven't really got into it? I don't know the answer to that question, but it's certainly intriguing to me.
Well, thank you for coming forward and
thank you.
Reaffirming that this is on the radar. And, you know, truth is, history is, a lot of our history is painful.
Yes, it is.
But it's important for us to know it, so thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to close the informational hearing on Chinese discrimination, and I'm going to go to Senator Knope's issue here. Senator Knope, I don't know if you want to do it from there. I'll bring your team up to the table on Education Emergency Act.
We'll let the team come up behind me.
Yeah, it is.
I'll kind of introduce the topic. Thank you for the opportunity, Chair Haas. My name is Senator Tim Knope from District 27. And I'm here before you today on behalf of the, what I am told is the world's largest hazelnut producer, my good friend, Senator Larry George. And his concept bill that I'm happy to help him out with. He is currently out of the country and so wasn't able to be here with you today. And this bill is the Education Equity Emergency Act. It is a concept bill. And education quality should not depend on income or zip code. The intent of this bill is simple, and it's to give disadvantaged students a greater chance to reach their educational goals. This bill will level the playing field for foster kids and other students who may be slipping through the cracks due to poverty or challenging upbringings that might require unconventional educational services. The legislation would also allow qualified students to use 90% of their state education funding for approved educational expenses like tutoring, education therapy, textbooks, online education programs, or high school and community college classes. It's based off of a successful model employed in Arizona and would also create college savings accounts for students where the annual funds that are not spent by the student would roll over into the Oregon College Savings Plan. Considering that students who take part in this program are those least likely to have someone looking out for their post-secondary goals, this savings option could be the best way to ensure disadvantaged youth attend college. We have requested an economic analysis, which we will present in February, should we be so honored by you, to have a hearing on this bill. An initial review of the analysis stated that given the enrollment criteria, the program would not have a negative fiscal impact on local school districts, and that's because it limits it to, I think, basically 0.5% of the budget for a school district, and I think that's unlikely to even be met even at that level. So the LC apparently is in LC and receiving a little special treatment down there, and we're hoping to have it back soon. So I haven't seen the actual final version of it yet, and I would answer questions, but since I don't have it, I guess we're not going to be able to do that. But we do have several people who I think wanted to just give you just a few minutes of what they think about the Emergency Education Equity Act. So.
Okay. Senator that, Bruce, did you want to?
I just want to correct something that Senator Knope said. Senator George is the world's largest hazelnut processor, not producer.
Okay. You are correct, sir, and
yes.
I stand corrected on that because there is a difference.
Yes.
And it comes from a person who does actually produce things.
That's right.
Okay.
Do we have
a
sign up here?
Yeah, we have a Steve, you and your
we've got three people here. One is a replacement. They can introduce themselves.
Come on up, yeah.
Chair Haas, Vice Chair Knoll, members of the committee, my name is Jessica Kuzno, and although some of you have seen me here before on behalf of ORCA or ARCAPA, today I'm just here on behalf of myself, so thank you. I appreciate your giving us a few minutes to speak to you today. I'd like to preface my comments with the statement that although I have children enrolled in the Oregon Public Schools, this bill wouldn't touch any of my children. They don't qualify for the program. That said, I believe this bill is an important brick in the educational structure we're building for our students in Oregon. As anyone who's had children or even dealt with them at length can attest to, children are all different. They like different things, they act in different ways, and they learn best in different situations. This is especially true for those students who have extra challenges in life to deal with. Whether these issues are physical, cognitive, or situational, these students need our support in allowing them the freedom to learn in the way that suits them the best. Our legislative system is a very good tool for enacting widespread changes in rules. However, it is a very poor way to make decisions on an individual basis. Those decisions are best left to the people who are directly involved. Deciding what type of education would encourage a student to learn to the best of their ability is one such situation. It is the parents of a student who will know how that student will best learn, and it should be the parents of the student who decide what type of school will best meet those needs. This bill takes a small step in that direction, and for that I applaud it. The bill has several specific provisions that are important to our community as a whole. The first provision is a description of who is an acceptable applicant. By defining a set group, the bill both levels the playing field for our most vulnerable students and ensures that the school districts will not be unduly burdened. Excuse me. Not every student would qualify for this program. Instead, it limits the program to only those students who meet certain requirements, students who have disabilities or need specialized services, and students who are from economically or socially disadvantaged backgrounds. These students would qualify for the program specifically because they are starting behind the eight ball and in need of our extra support. By targeting those children who have these specialized needs, it ensures that they have an additional chance at a meaningful education in our state. In addition to the above restrictions, the bill provides that no individual school district would be unduly burdened by the loss of their ADM. The cap, the half-percent cap, created within the bill would allow districts in poorer communities to ensure that they do not have to worry about a mass exodus. Instead, they can keep doing what they do best, teaching the majority of the students in their area. There's a third provision that ensures both the state and student needs are met within this bill. As it is written, this bill only allows parents a limited amount of freedom in how they use those tax dollars allocated to the education of their child. In no way would this bill give individuals a blank check to spend their education dollars. Rather, it provides a reasonable list of educational opportunities and materials that parents are able to choose from. Those spending opportunities are for items that we would hope to provide students with in any setting, including instructors, tutors, books, even savings for higher education. As an additional safeguard, the bill requires that the materials and instruction meet certain minimal standards. By allowing parents to choose the setting that their child accesses these opportunities and materials, this bill will afford our students a chance at an education that best prepares them to become productive members of society. As the session begins, please consider the bill closely and know that in supporting it, you'll be ensuring that the students in our state are given a chance at the best educational opportunities available. Thank you.
Go ahead, ladies. Okay. If you've got something to read and you want to just highlight it and hand it out, that works too.
Chair Haas and members of the committee, my name is Catherine Hickok. I'm the director of the Children's Scholarship Fund Portland. For 15 years, our program has provided privately funded partial tuition scholarships to low-income kids in our community. And since then, we've helped nearly 650 Oregon children have access to diverse educational settings that meet their individual needs.
Our program is a partner program of the National Children's Scholarship Fund headquartered in New York, and to be eligible for a scholarship, families must demonstrate financial need. Our experience with the educational choices made by these lower-income Oregon families demonstrates several key points that are relevant to this bill. First, lower-income parents really want to take charge of their kids' education, and they see a high-quality education as the way out of poverty for their kids. They make the commitment and sacrifice of paying, on average, more than half of their tuition costs out of their own pocket. Second, demand for diverse educational opportunities in Oregon is real. When our program began, the families of more than 6,600 kids applied for only 550 available scholarships, and I get phone calls and emails every week for our waiting list because we are still a very small program and can only help a small fraction of the kids who come to us for assistance. The last thing that the parents who call me want to do is see their kids not succeed in school, and there are all kinds of reasons why they want a different environment for their children. Third, it does not actually take a lot of money to change a child's life. Our scholarships average only about $1,500 for a full school year, and just that amount makes the difference in empowering low-income parents to be able to have access to a private school education. The average tuition of the schools that are participating in our program this year is only about $3,600, and the parents get to choose the school. Our scholarships go directly to the school, and they're free to leave, change schools at any time, so they're fully in control. So a relatively small amount of money truly can make the deciding difference for these families. While they don't have much discretionary income, our families must always pay part of the tuition themselves, and this ensures that they have skin in the game. They're highly engaged in researching their options, and they're very motivated. When empowered with a modest amount of financial help, parents will invest their own money, time, effort, and discipline to get the right education for their kids. A Portland area mother named Lisa recently told me, "I wish that the education system could understand that not every child fits into the same sized box, and everyone needs to do what is right for their family." I've witnessed the lengths to which parents like Lisa go to to choose the school they think is best for their kids. The empowerment scholarship accounts in this legislation would empower parents like Lisa to make those life-changing choices on behalf of their children's education just when they need it the most. So I encourage you to support the Education Equity Emergency Bill. Thank you very much.
Chairman Haas, Vice Chairman Knope, and representatives, members of the committee, thank you so much for allowing me to be here today. My name is Christina Rabali, and I'm a parent of two wonderful children here in the state of Oregon. I have had both of my children in traditional public schools and online charter schools. Currently, both of my children receive great educations in Yamhill County. While we've had the blessing of receiving great options in education, and my children have no special needs, others in Oregon aren't as fortunate. When I heard about the concept for the Educational Opportunity Scholarship Bill here in Oregon, I was excited to know that this could be an option for the most vulnerable children in our state. These types of opportunity scholarships have worked in other states such as Arizona, and we have an opportunity to do that here as well. We have the chance to give parents and caregivers the opportunity to choose the best educational options for those that they love. Can you imagine a better gift? I can't. Every good parent wants what is best for their kids, and it's heartbreaking when they can't afford it. The state doesn't have to incur hardly any costs in order to give these children a bright future. Can you imagine what could happen if these special needs students had the chance to choose their tutors or their right courses to meet their needs? We talk a lot about fairness in Oregon, and I can't think of anything more fair than giving the poorest, most disadvantaged children in our state the best options. Can you? These types of scholarships work, and we have proof of that. They give those who know the child best a real chance to choose instruction that meets their needs. Parents also have the flexibility to save and spend these dollars wisely and even put it towards college education in the future. Oregon has a chance to make a difference in these kids' lives. If we're a progressive state, let's make some progress here and give opportunity to financially and socially challenged children. Thanks once again for the opportunity to be here and for considering this bill.
Questions for our team?
Okay, and we also have some testimony in the record. Richard?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The committee received testimony from Mr. Richard Burke, Mr. Steve Buckstein is here, and Ms. Susan Pazdena, and so those three pieces of testimony will be added on the record and available online on the OLA system.
Okay. We're getting moved. No questions. Steve, did you want to add to what you presented already?
Okay.
Thank you, Chair House members of the committee. I'll be short. I tried to get one of the court-appointed special.
Start off with you.
Oh, Steve Buckstein with Cascade Policy Institute in Portland. Sorry. I tried to get on short notice one of the court-appointed special advocates here. These are volunteers in the community who work with children in the court system, foster kids who would be eligible for this program. None of them could make it, but so this is sort of secondhand testimony, but I thought it was so powerful when I talked to one of them yesterday that she said, even though the state of Oregon has some money available for these foster kids for higher education when they, quote-unquote, age out of the system, get to be 18, they feel, the kids feel that they've been so abused by the system by that time, they don't want the state's help. They don't want the money. They just want to get out of the system. And she told me that it is so important, she felt, that if the money could follow the child all the way through their K or first grade through 12th, it could make a huge amount of difference in these kids' lives. They get moved around from house to house to home. Sometimes they try to keep them in the same school district, but sometimes that doesn't happen. These kind of scholarships would allow them to have much more control over their own education, and we hope in February, if this bill is heard, that we can get one or more of the special advocates here to talk personally about the experiences with these kids that this program would help. Thank you.
Okay. Questions?
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Steve. Senator Knopf, did you have any closing?
I'm good.
Okay. Thank you all who came down. Senator Close is here, and I want to close out that informational hearing on Education Equity and Emergency Act. We'll await for the LC and move to accelerated study and associate programs with Senator Close. And we also have Mr. Edwards from OEIB to come up and talk along the same lines. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you, Chair Hass, and members of the committee. I am Senator Betsy Close, Oregon District 8, for the record. I appreciate your willingness to hold a hearing on LC 92, which we're calling Accelerated Study and Associates Program, ASAP. Our original intent with this bill was to try to bleed the core curriculum at community colleges together with vocational technical programs that many of the students are there to gain. However, there was a concern about dictating to the community colleges what they should provide, so we took a little different approach in this LC draft. This bill would direct the Accelerated Learning Committee to look at accelerated programs for career and technical education offered by the community colleges. The committee would seek to modify these programs so that they would align with the economic needs of the areas served. And as you know, in Oregon, we have many different things going on. We're a big state, and we want to be sure that the students we're graduating, you know, are finding opportunities right there where they're at, since many of them do so, look for work locally. In my district, we have a number of manufacturers who need machinists. We're a metals area down in the Lebanon area, Albany, and there's a lot of big plants down there. They're getting big contracts from places like Boeing. I call them Dreamliner contracts because they're doing very specified metal parts for Boeing. And it's highly technical. But I just toured a plant yesterday called Entech, and they said their problem is they need machinists, and they have plenty of young men that would like to be that. But they used to gain these skills in high school in the metal shop. And those programs are going away. They're disappearing. There's been a move recently. I just talked to our labor commissioner, and I understand he has a concept he's putting forward to start putting the woodshop classes back in high schools. And I commend him for that. Well, we really need a metal shop. I was a vocationally certified teacher, and those of you that have taught may know that there's really two big groups in high school. There's people you might call people that are head people, and they take science and math and college prep, and I did that. But then you have people that are work with your hands people, and they enjoy auto mechanics, and they enjoy working with machinery and tools, and they have an aptitude. And interestingly enough, that is what the need is in many communities, people that can work in plants. So it was real interesting to me to see a young man that made his start, one young man had started out at Lebanon High School in the metal shop class, and he had risen to the head machinist in this plant at 32, had mastered everything in the plant, and was thinking now of going to OSU to continue in engineering. And we see that a lot in our district, where these guys that have welding skills and they've done these Boeing contracts go to OSU. They get accepted to the engineering program because they know metals. And I've been told there's very few young men that know not just welding, but they know titanium and they know zirconium and how to do this very technical work. So I'm just here to try to get this voice heard, you know, before our groups that are working on higher education. This bill would address the need for adequate funding for that type of program. It would have a clause that specifically includes involving the Oregon Education Investment Board. Reference is made in the bill for the involvement of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, TEC, to be in consultation on the project. Just to begin the ball rolling and to get this part of our curriculum going forward for our students. Not every kid, as you all know, is going to go on to a four-year degree, and we're finding increasingly there's not jobs available in many places, but there are jobs for electricians, mechanics, machinists. In short, the need is great for trained technical workers. The dropout rate for community college freshmen, I am told, is nearly 50%. And I'm being told it's because they come into community college and they don't get to take the curriculum they're interested in. They have to take the core curriculum first, and it discourages them, frankly. So I think the best course of action is to expand our educational dollars for programs that meet the needs of students and the community, because there's a gap there. Thank you.
Thank you. Before we go to questions, let's go to Mr. Edwards from OEIB. And we talk briefly about this idea before, which seems pretty reasonable. Mm-hmm. Where are we?
Chair Haas, Vice Chair Canope. For the record, my name is David Edwards. I'm the Research and Policy Director for the Oregon Education Investment Board. I'm also one of two staff from the Office of the Chief Education Officer working with the Accelerated Learning Committee. I'm here to simply affirm that this legislative concept is in keeping with the intent and scope of the original legislation, and accordingly that the Accelerated Learning Committee is the proper venue for it.
Can you expand on that?
No quote.
Chair Haas.
He didn't make the quote. That's a quote.
Chair Haas, committee members, based on my reading of the proposed language, it would expand the scope of the Accelerated Learning Committee to take in the following. One, to review current community college career and technical education programs for value and efficacy. Two, to ensure those programs are aligned with regional economic needs, due in part to recent data which indicate Oregon colleges have historically underproduced degrees in key technical fields. Three, to review funding models for those programs with an eye toward possibly making strategic investments in critical areas. And four, to consult with the recently constituted Higher Education Coordinating Commission to ensure the committee's actions are in concert with the larger efforts to transform higher education.
So are you saying legislation is needed to do this or not?
Chair Haas, committee members, I believe that the current legislation allows for the committee to undertake these actions without the additional language. However, the additional language does clarify and emphasize the importance of the career and technical education.
Okay. Questions? Okay. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, committee.
I'm going to close the informational hearing on the ASAP concept. We'll go to our final issue of the day. Career and Technical Education Update. Brian Krieg, Laura Roach, and your team.
Senator Haas, members of the committee, my name is Brian Krieg. I am the co-chair of the Career and Technical Education Grant Advisory Committee for the state of Oregon. And it's a pleasure to be here in front of you again to talk about the CTE grant program that the legislature embarked upon in 2011. If we look back to 2011, the legislature put $1.8 million into the fund to let us start to bring back shop classes and other 21st century types of career classes in our schools across the state. In 2013, you increased the amount that was going to be available for the grants through a couple pieces of legislation, and the total for that is $8.8 million. Over the summer, the Grant Advisory Committee was reconstituted and worked with the Department of Education to put together a new RFP process. It was very successful. Our committee has 16 members on it. Half are appointed by the Labor Commissioner, half are appointed by the Chief of Schools, and about half are industry and half are education folks. We set new goals, elements, and changed some of the processes. We learned a lot from the 2011 grant process, and I think we came up with a much better RFP for the folks out there. DOE staff provided a great amount of instructional assistance. There were numerous webinars and materials that were put on the website to help those who were putting together a grant be successful in their applications on it. I think we had much higher grant applications that came back. And the big question on that was, how many did we have come back? We had 62 applications that came into us requesting over $21 million in actual funding. We did cap the amount of grants that would be awarded at $500,000. We also had a clause in the instructions that grants above $250,000, that at the time of grant awarding, that we could come back and ask a grant applicant to potentially lower the amount of their grant somewhat. A little bit of negotiating room. Problem being is that when we have an $8.8 million exactly amount, we would probably get down to one grant at the end where we might be able to fund one if we had, say, another small amount on that. And we did have that situation this year, and the applicants at the very top end with the largest grants were amenable and very helpful to us on that process, so that we were able to pick up at least one more grant on that. The process was very vigorous. We had 48 reviewers. These were volunteers from both industry and the education community. Over a third came from industry. Rigorous process. Every volunteer spent at least 20 hours of their time on this, with webinars, a full day in Salem, and then numerous hours on their own in the actual grant review process. I would like to note that we had grant reviewers who came from Eastern Oregon. We had them come from Medford. I had one of the business managers of the IBEW come out of Medford for this process. Great commitment from the folks who were doing this. Every reviewer had to review four grants because we wanted to make sure that we had a good overview. And then on one day, we brought all the reviewers together, teams of three, to look at the numbers and have a discussion about how they each scored the same grants that they were talking about. So very rigorous situation, because these are grants have a lot of creativity to them, very hard to try to make the adjustments on the numbers. So at the end, we actually funded 24 grants on that. We did have some caveats that the legislation had for us, that we had to meet at least $1 million worth of STEM activities. Well, about three quarters of the grants had STEM activities in them. That wasn't a hard challenge to meet within that selection. $1 million also for CTSO, the service organizations like DECA or Farm Bureau. Once again, about three quarters of them had that type of activity. We also had to have some diversity from both standard types of diversity we would look at in populations, but also from a geographical standpoint. A third of the grants needed to come from rural, and a third then from an urban environment, with the other third being somewhat in the middle. We were able to do that. We had a great scattering of grants across the state, and it did work out fairly well on readjusting the numbers to make sure that we covered and made sure that rural Oregon was included in this. The grants ranged from $195,000 to $495,000. Welding, manufacturing, and construction are a big part of that, but we had a lot of other types of activities. There were a lot of great grants that we weren't able to fund. If there were more money in the thing, I think most of the grants that we received were of a quality level that they could have been funded. My colleague Laura Roach will give you a little bit more flavor of some of the things that are involved with what we did fund out there. And my last comment will be, this morning Senator Dembro was chairing the Apprenticeship Ratio and Public Contracting Task Force, and for almost a half an hour they diverted into discussions about the need for the education and the pipeline and CTE elements in that. And it was a lot of industry folks all there. So this is a continuing issue within the building and within the community.
Mm-hmm. Chair Hess and members of the committee, I'm Laura Roach. I'm a director at the Oregon Department of Education for the Secondary Post-Secondary Transitions Team, and this is where career and technical education is seated. First of all, let me say thank you for your support over the last two legislative sessions in providing some funding for career and technical education. I think it has been extremely instrumental in raising the interest and level and signaling to the field that career and technical education is a very important part of Oregon's comprehensive education system. I, for one, was having a hard time accepting the fact that we were losing programs over time, but in working through this, we do realize that we had been losing programs, especially during the hard budget years. CTE was one of the first programs to go. You may know or remember from previous conversations, when we design, help schools and districts design programs, we are looking very strongly at the secondary, post-secondary connections and how our high school programs can align to the programs at the community college or university level. It is indeed a challenge. There is no question about it. But we also look for things like dual credit and job opportunities and post-secondary college opportunities. So when we look at the grants across the state, Brian has indicated for you, those grants range from basically $200,000 to $500,000. They were very diverse, and I've given you in a packet the summaries of the grants that you can see that they range from a lot of industrial and engineering programs to health services. And I think that that reflects career and technical education in a broad sense in our comprehensive high school programs. Many of our staff told us that it was very exciting work to write these grants. That the business and industry partnerships and the discussions that were started were very important to local school districts because they had reason to come together and talk about what they could do. I wanted to give you a little assurance that has come up out of past conversations, and we actually, of the 24 grantees, we asked them the question, who wrote your grant? And the answer, we got 22 of the 24 back. Two were written, of the successful grants, were written by a grant writer hired for the task. One grant was written by a dedicated grant writer in the district. So what that says is that this really was a collaborative process. Our regional CTE coordinators were involved in the grant writer. We had administrators involved in the grant writing, and just a variety of partners. So I just wanted to share that with you because that's a concern that has been underlying the grant competitive grant process all along, is can rural schools compete? Can those people or those programs that don't have a dedicated grant writer compete? And the answer is yes, they can. So at least they could this time. So the other thing that I wanted to share with you is in talking to some of the more successful grants, what they said is we've been planning for this for a long time. we were in place. We have had 5 or 6 years of planning. We have written grants before, and we weren't successful. But this time, you know, the confluence of opportunities came together, and we were successful. So I think that's good information for us. We did see a lot of innovation in the grants, and, of course, with innovation comes a little bit of risk, but we feel good about the potential for all these grants. My staff plan to visit these schools and districts late this spring, the new ones, again in the fall, and hopefully again the following year before the closure of the program, not to only to garner good information about what's working and what's not working and where do we need to go from there. So they would be the comments I would share with you. If you have questions, I'm more than happy to try to answer them. But again, thank you for your continued support.
Thank you, Senator Wilburn.
Thank you. Since you got to look at all of the grants, and we only got the copies of the ones that made it, and that was 24 out of 60-some, I think what you said.
Correct.
So a little over a third. Are the others programs that could be successful and are worthy? I mean, is it an issue of lack of resources as opposed to lack of good quality programs that could be funded?
Chair Haas, Senator Roblin, yes. There's, I would say the vast majority of the ones that came in were good ideas and programs. There were a few that might have scored a little bit lower, that, but with a little bit of assistance in telling them what maybe they needed to buff up on them, I think even those programs were worthy of moving forward with. The issue for some was just the fact this takes a little while to prepare for. As was noted, there was a few of the groups that really had already started maybe in these directions, and a lot of them that came in this time did not apply last time because they weren't ready at that point. And a few of the ones that applied last time that were maybe a little not so polished, they came back a lot better on this too. So we're seeing this kind of forward momentum is what I'm getting at on it. And yes, funding is what is keeping us from continuing on down the list of the programs.
Yeah, I was going to follow. Is the money mostly being used for staffing, for materials, for planning? What is there a trend to that? I mean, is there certain things that we should be helping provide if we're going to continue to have CTE programs that's obvious?
Chair Haas, Senator Roblin, the nature of these grants, right from the get-go when we came to you in 2011 looking to start this program, was that they needed to be jumpstart grants, help pick somebody up maybe or start something new where they didn't have something. I mean, we have high schools that don't have shops in them because they're new buildings. It's not even a concept there. So staffing is not a focus because that's something that's not necessarily sustainable out there in a district. Now, not saying that there isn't some staffing that is involved with here where they're getting commitments maybe from the community and getting themselves running. Staff training, on the other hand, is an element that it does permeate through many of the grants. Equipment, new plasma laser cutters were at a number of places. Fully, as one of the pie charts there shows, construction and manufacturing were the dominant areas on there. And I have to say, manufacturing was throughout a lot of the grants, and it was buying 3D printers. It was plasma cutters, other types of equipment of that nature. Virtual welding machines were a big one for that. I think one of the grants I looked at was in John Day, one of our smallest grants on there, but it was really right-sized and right for the community. Teaching welding, getting the middle schoolers starting using the virtual welding machines to help cut costs on that, tied all the way through to getting the welding certs through the community college over in Ontario. And that's the type of connectivity on it, and putting the equipment, some of the supplies in there, but knowing that they have to fund themselves into the future, and then trying to figure out maybe there's a stream of some way that they can even generate that funding. We have the folks over in the Umatilla area, I believe. Home builders were very involved with that grant with them. They're going to build a house, and then they're going to sell the house, and those proceeds will go to build the next house. So trying to move themselves forward. Some great creativity on there. Even, you know, business class type stuff that is going on with these programs.
Senator Barr. Sure. Brian, how many of these had some linkage to an apprenticeship program?
Chair Haas, Senator Meyer, I don't have a number off the top of my head. It was a few. It wasn't as many as we would have hoped for the formal apprenticeship programs on that, and still trying to figure out, okay, how can we patch that together a little bit more on it. Though what I would say is there are some of the apprenticeship, the folks who are involved in the apprenticeship programs are helping with the schools and all. So it wasn't really a formal. We do, down in Reedsport, the community charter school, sorry, Senator Robin.
I knew that one, but I was going
to point that out. And it's a welding-oriented program there, an apprenticeship program there. Marine welding is a key area there on that.
I think these are great efforts. I would really like to see some way of linking more strongly as a feeder into apprenticeship programs. I think we've lost a lot by not doing more of that. And as we talk a lot about the cost of education, and I mean, one of the things that's been sort of lost is the way things used to work, where there was a partnership between laboring organizations and businesses to train the workforce. And a lot of those were people got into the training program and into the craft, paying while they learned and actually having the training paid for, which I thought was a great program.
Yeah, I agree with that. The hard part of that is that you have to have enough of the industry going on in the place to have the time for the apprenticeships. So, you know, in our rural areas, it's very difficult. I mean, I think they picked one because you've got Soss Brothers and some other people, right, who do the welding. But so they have an ongoing group. But so often, electricians, it's keeping enough electricians going. Having an electrical apprenticeship program is pretty tough. So you can get them the skills so they're ready for the next step, and you can show them where they're going to need to move to if they want to get that final apprenticeship, but it's really hard to connect them, I think. Though we're hoping, if some other things happen in Goose Bay, that there'll be a lot of electrical jobs and a lot of concrete construction jobs. That might allow for, and it's a long enough project that might allow for some direct.
Senators, if you look to the, I can show you a number of the centralized, regionalized programs, or
if
the
you're
apprentices
near those,
come from all over there on a weekend.
Exactly. That's the,
even,
yeah, you guys have some really great programs in around the Eugene area with.
There's a lot people in Southern Oregon. There's a lot.
Yeah, we've got one in Coos Bay for plumbers. So, yeah.
You mentioned that these are jumpstart, some of these. What happens then when these grants run out? Does that jumpstart keep, you know, leverage them forever, or are they, are you obligated to continue this next time? Do they sort of have like, well, you know, this is how we keep running? We run into this kind of thing in foundations a lot when you give out grants and leveraging capacity and program. How many of those jump starts will now be permanent?
Chair Haas, it looks like we were fairly successful with the first seven grants that we gave out. I think maybe there's only one program that has you know, some significant challenges to it. I know one of them, it was Canby, they had to reduce the size of the scope of the program a little bit for one of their staff people on it, but most of them are moving ahead. And we were pretty firm about telling folks that we weren't going to be letting them go back to the well. Didn't mean a district couldn't reapply, but it would need to be something different that they were doing. Or in the case of, say, an ESD, where they were doing two sets of high schools, maybe they were going to expand it to another set of high schools and leveraging some, economics in the situation on that. Really, I think we only had one that really kind of came back really asking to be shored up again. This is part of the reason that in looking at the grants, sustainability was one of the highest benchmark things that they had to show and one of the key things that they got scored on. And then also having staff going and working with them over the year, doing the reviews on that to make sure that we're trying to do the best we can with the monies on it. But there is a little bit of a risk and a gamble. Some programs, you know, you could have one that fails out there.
Okay.
That's okay, by the way.
Yeah, it is okay. But you know, one of the problems is in the past we had vocational money coming from the federal government that helped support these. And the truth is, really good CT programs are more expensive than an English or a math class. And over time, you buy some plasma cutters, and over time you're going to have to replace those. And having a district fit that into their budget, they might have it and save it for a long time, and then the economy goes down, they have to spend it to keep regular classes going. And that's what happened to CTE over the last number of years. So I hope the state considers that as time goes on. We get these programs started and going. You know, 5, 6, 7 years out, they're going to start having to replace some of the stuff. And if they can't reapply or if there isn't federal help, it's going to be hard to keep them just because you aren't going to be able to keep up with the technology that's happening.
May I respond to that? Senator Hass and Senator Rowland, one of the things that we did in this grant, you see the language called Program of Study. And while we don't hold these grant applications to exactly the standards of a Program of Study that we have defined with our federal funding,
right.
What we are seeing is we're a little more generous in our definition of what that is, but we're seeing those programs move into the same status as a Program of Study, which is defined through our federal application. And when they do that, and they then can become eligible for federal funding ongoing. My thought is, in future federal fundings, the bar is going to be higher, and it also may be more narrow in what the federal government is willing to support. But as long as there are high-wage, high-demand kinds of programs leading to high-wage, high-demand, they may be very well in very good position. So I'm hopeful, and we're hearing some good things out of the federal legislature, that our federal legislators are supporting career and technical education, trying to bring back a little bit of that funding. So we're hopeful for that. We never know for sure. Life changes on a daily basis, but that possibility is still there if they move toward the little more stringent requirements around our federally funded programs.
Well, thank you for the update.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And that's the last thing on our agenda today. Committee,
we meet. We haven't had any meetings in February, or we're just going to say the heck with it.
I was going to say we meet exactly 19 days from now, February 4th, and the timing is such that if we were to pass a bill out of this committee to the floor, it may very well be the very first bill considered in the Oregon State Senate in this next session. So
there you go.
There's an opportunity there.
And we do have a new senator, don't we?
Yes, we do.
That's right.
So thank you all for participating. If there's nothing else before us, we are adjourned.